Thanks for tuning in and welcome to IMRU Radio Magazine. I'm Abby Dees.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
Tonight, Vash Bodhi reports from the Tribeca Film Festival on a film that's at Outfest, Gay Chorus Deep South.
And we chat in studio with Mark Patton, the star of Nightmare on Elm Street 2, about the Outfest documentary Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street.
But first, the honest tea.
And it's a wonderland of legal questions this week, so why don't you start?
Okay. I really tried to find some upside here.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been really, you and I have been really wanting this not to be the Debbie Downer segment.
I know.
We have failed this week. This is all about human rights. And human rights are not currently in an upswing.
No, they're not doing well at all.
Let's start with asylum.
We can't hear enough about asylum.
We can't. And so I'm actually about to take a volunteer asylum case with with a Trans Latina Coalition. So I'm on this crash course about asylum. And what I have learned so far is that everything we hear about it on the news is completely decontextualized and wrong.
I mostly get my news from Samantha Bee anymore.
She's actually as accurate as they come
on
this one. But there is a new asylum policy that has been announced. Not the first new asylum policy that has been announced this year, and we'll get to some of the earlier ones. But the newest one requires asylum-seeking immigrants who pass through a third country en route to the U.S. must first apply for refugee status in that country rather than at the U.S. border, or they become ineligible for asylum in the U.S.
And this is specifically the southern border.
The southern border.
Not that you're going to walk through Canada from anywhere, but...
You could.
Sure.
Maybe. Russia? I don't know. Okay.
No.
So who are the people that are, by and large, asking for asylum on our southern border? They are Central American migrants, which means they have passed through Mexico to get here. And so that means they must make an asylum claim in Mexico.
And, of course, the federal government cleared it with Mexico. And I believe Guatemala is involved in this, too.
Oh, yeah. There are discussions about what this safe third country thing is. Now, safe third country is a recognized asylum concept where countries have agreements to be a safe third country. That's not what's happening here. There is only one country that the U.S. has a safe third country agreement with, and that would be Canada.
Okay. So nobody ran this by Mexico or Guatemala or anybody before.
They have sort of run it by Mexico, and Mexico is not pitching a fit, although they are sort of squawking a little quietly.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that Mexico is we have them over a barrel because of trade.
Right.
And so Mexico is kind of going, all right, yeah, no, we'll go along with this. And so what the deal is that a lot of people from Central America are in these southern parts of Mexico by this law, or they will be required to first claim asylum, get rejected from asylum before they can make a claim in the U.S. Now, think about this for trans and LGBTQ people generally coming from those countries. That part of Mexico has a lot of gang and corruption stuff, the gangs from Honduras and...
Well, and is Mexico even set up for asylum?
It's not set up to do this. They are a signatory to the relative, you know, agreements going back to 1951 and 1967. But so is Russia. And so are a lot of, you know, African countries that are hanging us and killing us.
Right.
That doesn't mean a whole hell of a lot.
Well, because, I mean, we always assume that the whole world is set up like America for immigration. But in fact, you try to immigrate to another country. They're not set up for it. They really are not.
The big question I have about this, and I honestly don't know the answer, is... The requirement is they must apply for asylum in Mexico, then get rejected before they can make a claim in the U.S. So assuming, to me, that means if they get rejected for an asylum claim, they are at risk of being deported by Mexico to their home countries. And, of course, risk of death and persecution there.
Right. And, of course, I think that was the point I was trying to get to was how long would it take to get rejected by Mexico, a country that's not really, they don't have a streamlined system where you can just... Although,
no,
I mean...
We barely do now.
Maybe they could sit on the border with a rubber stamp and just reject people to move things along.
Well, it sounds like those are the kinds of things that are happening. And there is, like, notorious corruption and many, many, many reports of people being subjected to violence and rape, and especially gender nonconforming people. You know, all LGBTQ people are at risk. So there are also no anti-discrimination protections recognized for trans people in Mexico. So it stands to reason that they're not going to be going out of their way to provide asylum based on claims of anti-trans threats and violence.
Right, and plus, when you're in this asylum situation, you're in a crowded situation. You don't have a support group. You don't have backup.
Process.
No, there's nobody to stand up for you if everything goes wrong.
Let's put this in context. Asylum is a right.
Yes.
To have asylum is not a right. The right to claim asylum is
right.
A right. That is U.S. law. That is international law to which the U.S. has signed on. You have a right to claim asylum. That is not unlawful.
Although I read that the DHS is now regarding it as discretionary benefit.
Well, it is. Granting asylum is
yeah.
discretionary. It is. But we are at this point so far beyond our own law around this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are exceptions to this. You can demonstrate that you are at risk of persecution in the country you're coming through. That's difficult. I mean, this
how
is
do you demonstrate that, though?
News articles, witnesses. I mean,
yeah.
So you don't. People fleeing don't generally have a binder.
No,
of country
I know.
Conditions with them.
I know,
and so
we
this,
know what Central America's like.
This requires lawyers and
yeah.
due process,
yeah.
and you know the
yeah.
trust that the person you're talking to is not totally corrupt.
Right.
So, obviously, big problem with this. And then this is on top of a policy that was announced by the Trump administration in January called the Remain in Mexico policy, which requires people coming to our southern border.
Mm-hmm.
So they made it through Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And this was sort of prior to this.
And Mexico is a very long country.
It's a very long country. To stay on the Mexican side of the border awaiting mm-hmm. their asylum hearing in the U.S. An asylum hearing they have a right to.
Mm-hmm.
By our own law.
Mm-hmm.
But same problem. They are being sent south of the border. They are not guaranteed due process. There are many, many reports of violence and intimidation and corruption in the border officials south of the border, and many reports by migrant workers, people that are connected with organizations in Mexico mm-hmm. and in the U.S., that the actual workers, attorneys,
mm-hmm.
translators, the people that are ensuring that these people who have a right to claim asylum
right.
in the U.S., these people are being deported by Mexico.
I would think at the most basic level, Mexico doesn't have an infrastructure
it
to house and process people the same way this country didn't have an infrastructure to suddenly start housing children.
Right.
And now we have concentration camps.
There are gangs
overnight.
At the borders.
Yeah.
And the government has been very reticent to step in and protect the migrants and the
mm-hmm.
people working with the migrants
mm-hmm.
from the gangs. Just common sense on this one. And
right.
these cities and places they're being required to stay
mm-hmm.
on the south side of the border are the very same cities that the State Department is warning U.S. citizens away from because
right.
of the gang violence and corruption. So, again, and then imagine LGBTQ people. And that is why we're talking about this. This is an LGBTQ issue. Now, there's a funny little twist for this.
I know I was going to ask you about that because that is where my face started to hurt. It was so confusing to me.
The Washington Examiner article?
Yes.
Okay. Washington Examiner, if you do not know, is not the Washington Post.
No.
Notoriously conservative
mm-hmm.
newspaper. But even they
mm-hmm.
published a very interesting article about LGBTQ migrants in this situation, saying that they had talked to border officials who say they are well aware that it is U.S. policy that LGBTQ people are exempt from the Remain in Mexico policy, meaning that they should be allowed to stay in the U.S. because of the threats to their lives.
Which would be lovely if it were, written down somewhere.
It's not written down
no.
anywhere.
And that's the best part. It's not written down because if they wrote it down, then everybody would find out and they would just come to the border and
start
say,
saying I'm gay.
I'm gay. So that's why it's not written down, but it's true, but it's not true.
But then, and even, so hush-hush, no written proof, and the officials that the Washington Examiner says they
mm-hmm.
talked to said it's not because Mexico doesn't want LGBTQ people,
mm-hmm.
but because they're worried that these people will be harmed in Mexico. And so then somebody else said, I thought this was revealing, if the policy exists, it would make sense. The rumor is making the round, said a senior border official. So is this policy or just a rumor?
I know. The idea that anything that should be written down is nothing more than a rumor and not even a verified rumor.
So NPR and people like that have
yeah.
also been talking to custody officials who say, yes, in fact, vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the guidance does say vulnerable populations.
Right.
On a case-by-case basis.
Unaccompanied minors.
Accompanied minors. That's, I think, one of the only enumerated groups. Then there's right. some other things.
And if you have physical or mental problems,
yes.
like if you're pregnant or something like that.
So
and
those are vulnerable populations.
Yes.
LGBTQ people are considered vulnerable populations. But in reality,
yeah.
no one knows what's going on. And
no.
a lot of those people have been sent back to Mexico. And we're not talking sent to Mexico for a week.
No.
We're talking possibly up to 5 years. It takes a long time to get a hearing. I mean, when I was talking to the Trans Latina Coalition about volunteering, I said, so how long does one of these cases take? Mm-hmm. They said, be prepared. It could take 2 years typically.
And what do people do when they're trapped in a country? They don't have citizenship. They don't have the right to work there. They don't. I mean, what do people do?
Theoretical rights, according to international law. They have some
rights
to work.
Is that comforting?
No, it's not comforting in this situation. It's obviously not working in the U.S. And there's mm-hmm. very little enforcement mechanism for this.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to make a comment here. If you are a lawyer, if you're a social worker, if you're a mental health worker, if you speak good Spanish and English, I don't believe you need to be a registered, licensed translator. People need you. And I was surprised when I called the Trans Latina Coalition. I mm-hmm. said, my Spanish is crap. I am mm-hmm. not an immigration lawyer. Can I do anything? And they said yes. And so,
I mean, you do have to have a law degree. You don't.
Well, to do
they
lawyer
don't just want
stuff.
Enthusiastic people.
No, to do lawyer
oh, okay.
stuff. But honestly, if you have anything, that this is such yeah. a huge problem.
And you can work from a distance. You don't have to go to the border.
Well,
or do you?
No. I mean, I would be going to court. To represent people in their asylum hearings. But there
okay.
are all sorts of things. There's another organization doing amazing work in California
mm-hmm.
and in Tijuana called mm-hmm. Al Otro Lado.
Mm-hmm.
The other side is what mm-hmm. that, to the other side is what that means.
Right.
They've got amazing volunteer stuff going on. There are a bazillion organizations looking for people, desperate for people. And if there were a time to get involved, I would say it is now.
Okay.
So,
moving
that being
on.
Said, the Commission on Unalienable Rights.
Which is such a creepy, I know, it's come up before and it's such a creepy title to begin
Let's
with.
Let's pause for a second. What are unalienable rights?
Well, apparently they're based on natural law.
Yes. Well, in law school you learn, I mean, this is like in our Declaration of Independence, mm-hmm. it says that, you know, we are all endowed by our creator. And remember, put an asterisk around creator.
Yeah.
With certain unalienable rights. Unalienable right. means basically you can't give them away, sell them.
Right.
You never waive your rights.
Right.
But that creator thing is what this is all about. So Secretary of State Michael Pompeo announced the formation of this commission on unalienable rights a few months back, and we talked about it, to ostensibly provide advice on human rights and, quote, re-examine unalienable rights since the 1948 Universal Declaration on Human Rights.
And I feel like we're sitting in a hen house staring at a whole row of foxes.
We are. So here's an example of what we mean. And oh, to back up for a second, the core of this thing is to look at human rights in the context of natural law.
Mm-hmm.
That is not natural law like the theory of gravity
no.
or perhaps the theory of evolution. No, it's natural law, meaning law created by our creator.
Yeah.
Okay. Which we can,
and we've been talking about that pretty much every week.
Reasonable folks might disagree about this.
Mm-hmm.
Not going to get into that argument,
no.
but that's a religious principle. And here's an example. It means God created man and woman, and thus natural law says that they should only hook up with each other and stay men and women. That's just natural law.
Mm-hmm.
This is what we're talking about. So a couple of weeks ago, that commission was formally launched, and now we have a clearer idea of what they're up to. So.
Well, I think the people they're looking out for are those poor, oppressed religious people.
Yes,
who
that is
want
what this is
who
all
yes
about.
Who want to discriminate based on their religious beliefs
and
that is natural law to them.
That is natural law to them. I will just say, natural law does not exist, and the Creator does not exist in our
mm-hmm.
Constitution. We have a First Amendment. We have
mm-hmm.
freedom from religion. I don't have a problem with
mm-hmm.
religious freedom. I have a problem with religious rights trumping everybody else's rights. But the people that have been announced to run this commission are the proof in the pudding.
A rogues gallery, as we used to politely say.
The first one is the commission chair, who is Harvard Law Professor Mary Ann Glendon. She's gotten awards for pro-life
mm-hmm.
work.
Yeah.
And she penned a Wall Street Journal op-ed about same-sex marriage, calling it a social experiment that will harm the rights of children.
My favorite part, though, she blurbed an anti-trans book that called for the erasure of trans people, and she referred to that tome as eminently readable and insightful.
And good fun, I'm sure. Good fun. Other commission members, Christopher Tollefson, who said that contraception is morally impermissible.
Mm-hmm.
Jacqueline Rivers, the executive director of the Seymour Institute on Black Church and Policy Studies, has a record of anti-choice advocacy and opposition to same-sex marriage, and recently said, today marriage faces new threats as the divinely established order of marriage between one man and one woman is challenged. And she also signed on to a pledge against same-sex marriage, calling it a parody and a fiction.
And can we add Peter Berkowitz,
yes, we can.
Who, in reference to the Supreme Court's 2003 ruling overturning sodomy laws, he called that dangerous.
Yes.
Dangerous.
We've got Rabbi Meyer Soloveitchik. That's good.
It sounds Slavic.
Thank you. Who was part of the White House Hanukkah reception. He is against coverage for contraception under the Affordable Care Act. And Hamza Yousef praised Turkish President Erdogan despite, major human rights abuses. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Trump's own record on human rights suggests this is all par for the course.
Yeah.
So commentators are saying that this seems to make it clear that the point of the commission is to actually undo or exempt the U.S. from agreed-upon definitions of human rights.
And I bet whatever they're up to is going to happen very, very, very quietly.
Oh, yes, it's going to happen quietly. really, they are trying to winnow it down. Pompeo said in the Wall Street Journal this month that human rights advocates turn their energy towards new categories of rights after the Cold War. When politicians and bureaucrats create new rights, they blur the distinction between unalienable rights and ad hoc rights. Ad hoc rights, I'm willing to bet, are the rights that you and I are claiming as LGBT people, not anything that anybody really cares about, apparently.
I think the whole point seems to be make the world so baffling, we just sort of throw up our hands and give up.
Yeah.
Stop paying attention.
Yeah.
Because it's overwhelming.
It is overwhelming.
Every week we've got more to discuss. And we did have a story that at first seemed, it's not really lighthearted, but it seemed lighthearted.
That's the context we're in now. We take laughs where we can get them.
Yeah, because in Poland, apparently, and this is not a national government thing, it's sort of a town-by-town, region-by-region thing, but they have declared themselves free of LGBT ideology.
Yay!
Whatever that means. Because what is LGBT ideology? But we thought, this is funny. This is silly. This is just, crazy, crazy Poland, running toward the right wing. Oh, no, it got worse. So now one of their right wing magazines is distributing stickers for your business to declare your business an LGBT-free zone, which is a circle slash over a rainbow.
And so why is this, do we wonder, that this is all happening in Poland? Because it's a Catholic country. Don't be fooled by the USSR moment.
No.
This is a Catholic country, and the Vatican views LGBTQ equality as a violation of, guess what?
Natural law. And plus, this is also a throwback to pre-World War II when you had the Jew-free zones, and you would proudly boast that your business did not cater to Jews.
And Poland has a especially complicated record on that one.
Yes,
can
uncomfortable
you say
little
Warsaw
history.
Ghetto?
Yeah.
Actually, Warsaw is one of the few cities that's very, very unabashedly pro-LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to be in Poland in a couple of months and in one of these cities, Lublin, that have proudly declared themselves free of LGBT ideology. I have actually been online. I gave HRC money, which I don't normally do. Nothing against HRC. They're just not one of my top people to give money to.
There are so many.
A bunch of rainbow swag, and I am going to be parading my way through Poland. Wish me luck.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So one upside on this one.
Why are you going to Lublin?
Oh, long story. My partner's people are from there.
Oh.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, Samchek.
Samchek, yeah. Actually, that name got changed in Ellis Island. Long story.
Okay.
But Georgette Mosbacher, the U.S. ambassador to Poland, actually did denounce the stickers on Twitter, so not all is totally lost in U.S. diplomacy.
Although, sidebar, when did Georgette Mosbacher become the ambassador to Poland? I remember her as a boldface name in Vanity Fair back in the 80s.
Oh.
Or the 90s. Yeah,
the name was familiar, but I was trying to figure it out.
She was a socialite, if memory serves. She's one of those people who kept marrying well. I realize many people have become ambassador through simply wealth and connections.
That's the sort of what.
But when I saw her name there, I thought, Georgette Mosbacher?
Yeah, well.
I mean, Shirley Temple did it, too.
That's true.
Not in Poland. I have friends who used to work in the State Department in Warsaw.
Well, find out what's going on for
them. It was 20 years ago.
So anyway, we will keep posted on this. Hell, I might be posting from Poland.
I know, yeah. We did hope that Polish story was going to be sort of darkly funny, and then it took just a flat-out dark turn.
Just dark.
So anyway, that was this week's Honesty. But next week, sunshine, roses, lollipops.
We're going to try our best.
Okay. In response to a wave of discriminatory anti-LGBTQ laws in southern states and the divisive 2016 election, the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus embarked on a tour of the American Deep South.
And that journey was captured in the documentary Gay Chorus Deep South. Auerbach Bodie interviewed the filmmaker a few weeks ago at the Tribeca Film Festival, and we'd like to share that story once again since the film is playing at Outfest this Friday, July 26th.
This is Vosh Bodie with another TTV. Talk to Vosh. Today, I am at the Tribeca Film Festival on the red carpet to speak with the creative team behind Gay Chorus Deep South, a documentary which shows how a little courage and a lot of music can change the hearts and minds of many. I start with the film's director, David Charles Rodriguez. Hi, David. How are you?
I'm good. I'm doing great.
Congratulations on the film. Why did you decide to do this film?
I was really looking for a story that could help deal with the divisiveness that the country's facing right now, and there's nothing more powerful than music to do that. So when I learned about the tour that the chorus was having in the southern states of America, I thought that could be the most beautiful way to use entertainment to really touch people's hearts and to really prove that we're actually not that divided after all.
This film is about love. What was the most surprising place that you found love in making this film?
At a Southern Baptist church in Greenville, South Carolina. It was the first time ever in history that a gay chorus performed at a Southern Baptist church. And what happened, you guys will have to see in the film.
And this film is also about having really difficult conversations. How were you able to get people to have some of these difficult conversations?
I learned, especially making this film and working with the chorus, that the best way to be heard is if you listen. So we went there with open hearts and an open mind, and we listened to everyone. I even interviewed every single protester that was at the performances, and I spoke to them and treated them as human beings, because that's what we all are. And in the end, we all want the same things, which are family, togetherness, and a place that we can all belong.
If you could summarize this film with a hashtag, what would it be?
Y'all means all.
Thank you very much. Congratulations. Have a great time tonight. Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
I'm Tim Seelig. I'm the artistic director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus.
I'm Chris Verdugo. I am the executive director of the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus.
What was it like being on tour for this project?
Oh, my goodness. It was life-changing, really, and we used that probably way too much. This really was. We went from San Francisco to the South thinking one thing, and we came back with a completely different idea.
That's remarkable. So what was your favorite song that you guys sang while on tour?
I think my favorite song was a Holly Near piece that is, I ain't afraid of your churches, your Jesus, or your Bible. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
That's a very long title for a song, but I'm sure...
I'll give you the title, I Ain't Afraid.
What did you find was the most impactful song?
You know, the one that was most impactful was More Friends Than You Know. It was because we sang to a lot of youth and a lot of people that feel very alone in the South. And that told them that it's not just us, but if you look around, you'll find the friends that you need.
And you?
Truly Brave. It's a mashup of True Colors and Brave. And it's really inspiring. It just swells to this moment that it touches something in your core. And it touches you every single time you hear the song. It's just such an anthem about really standing up and being who you are, being your authentic self, being courageous, being brave, and knowing that you were loved for that. I think the two songs go a little hand in hand, actually.
This film is also about love. Where was the most surprising place that you found love?
I would say it had to be Greenville, South Carolina, at the First Baptist Church of Greenville, South Carolina, which is really the ultimate moment in the film.
Yeah, I want to add this sort of, on one of the pre-trips, we met with the police department from Knoxville, who was also doing our security. And this moment isn't in the film, but we had a rather contentious moment with one of their police members. And he said something to the effect of, we really don't care what you all think about us in California. And so that really kind of started this anxiety between us, and I didn't know if we had chosen the right company to come with us on tour. Halfway through the tour, he comes up to me and he says, I have invited my entire family to the concert tonight after seeing what you have done the past 4 days on the road. And that's how change happens, just by showing up and showing people why we're really here and opening your hearts. And for me, like, that was a moment that sort of just coalesced everything we had been working on, was to go, here's the transformation right before my eyes.
So if you could summarize the movie in a hashtag, what would it be?
Go see it. That's the short hashtag. And just let it immerse yourself in it and the stories that are told, and enjoy the music, but mostly the stories. Yeah, that's my hashtag, go see it.
I can't add to hashtag go see it. Hashtag go love it.
Perfect, you guys. Hey, Rocket Man, how are you?
I'm good.
So I'm talking to Lance Bass. What brings you out here tonight?
To support this film festival and the Gay Men's Chorus. You know, I think it's so incredible what they do. The messaging that they bring to all these towns that need to see these guys is inspiring. You know, as a little kid from Mississippi, I would have loved to have seen that growing up.
Well, when you came out, it was a very, very big deal. There was a generation of people that all of a sudden had to be confronted with the fact that someone that they loved was gay. Have you felt that impact?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely have felt that impact. When I came out, it was a different time. It was very scary and a career killer, but I just couldn't hold it in anymore. So, you know, I just threw my hands up and I was like, whatever happens, happens. But it went very positive when I came out, and the support I got, and to see a younger generation feel comfortable enough to say, oh my gosh, you know what? I'm gay too, just because I influenced that, you know, with my story. So, you know, it's incredible. And if I can help just one person out there love themselves a little more, I'm happy.
This film is about love. During your coming out process, where was the surprising place that you found love and acceptance?
Oh, good question. I mean, the surprising one was the entertainment industry. You know, it's, you know, there's a lot of gay community in the entertainment industry, but it's still very homophobic, like ridiculously homophobic, and especially music. So I think I was most surprised by the industry really having my back. The Jay Leno's of the world, you know, not making fun of it, making it a positive story. You know, I thought the comedians were going to have a field day with it, but they actually made the story positive so that they could influence, you know, some young kids out there to become themselves.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you very much. You have a really wonderful night. It's really a pleasure to meet you. This is Vosh Bodhi, and you have been listening to David Charles Rodriguez, Tim Selig, Chris Verdugo, and special guest Lance Bass, talking about the documentary Gay Chorus Deep South and our journey towards love, unity, and equality for all. To find out how you can see Gay Chorus Deep South, visit gaychorusdeepsouth.com. Remember, if you have a story to tell, TTV, talk to Vosh.
After the break, we return for What's My Story with Scream Queen Mark Patton.
Stick around, we'll be right back.
It's time for Who Said That? On this episode of The Rainbow Minute. This popular music singer was born in 1935 and grew up in San Francisco. His father, a vaudeville singer, taught him vaudeville routines and introduced him to singers like Ella Fitzgerald and Lena Horne. In high school, he was an excellent athlete with an eye on the Olympics. In his early 20s, collaborating with producer and arranger Mitch Miller, he became the consummate romantic ballad crooner with hits like Wonderful, Wonderful, as well as Chances Are. He became one of the wealthiest black entertainers of his time. Speaking in lyric form, he once said, "I really, really enjoy music, and that's why I do what I do." Who said that? It was Johnny Mathis, who finally made it to the Olympics, not as an athlete, but as a singer. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Yes, it's true. You could have more friends, a better job, more money, and enjoy the kind of life you've always dreamed about. Homosexuals in America are better educated, travel more, and enjoy a higher standard of living than their straight counterparts. If you've ever sat alone watching television on a Saturday night, or felt like your life was going nowhere, maybe homosexuality is right for you.
Hi, this is Margaret Cho, and you're listening to I Am RU on KPFK FM.
I am RU.
I am RU.
Welcome back. I'm Abby Dees.
I'm Wenzel Jones, and you're listening to I Am RU Radio.
Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, sets the record straight about the controversial sequel to A Nightmare on Elm Street, which ended Mark Patton's acting career just as it was about to begin.
So, Mark Patton, what's your story?
I'm in town for Outfest. My documentary, Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, is having a special preview here in Los Angeles. And I'm here to talk about homophobia in show business and the place of Nightmare on Elm Street in queer history now.
Well, and we're talking about Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which was the second, well, of course, it was 2, in what would turn out to be a franchise that ran for how many movies?
11.
Yeah, and this is the one with Freddy, because I'm not a horror movie person, but I know Freddy.
Well, you know, it's so funny in our documentary, it's hysterical. It's interesting when we meet people who say, oh, you know, I'm not a horror fan or whatever, which is me included in that. But we have clips of Ronald Reagan, George Bush, Donald Trump, all referencing Nightmare on Elm Street and
Freddy Krueger
politically, and using him as a political trope. So this series is, it's pop culture history. It's the number one horror franchise in the world and has been for quite some time. So it has a lot of power. It's a powerful tool for teaching if you want to use it that way.
And one of the things that is at the core is what was unusual about the film that you were in was that it had a very obvious, probably more obvious to queer people, gay subtext.
Well, yes. I mean, people say that. But actually, as we look at it more and more and more, it's the real problem is it probably not homosexual, actually. It's probably gender. People were not prepared for a boy to play a victim. So I actually, Jesse, in the character of Jesse, I play a woman's part. I am passive. I am terrified. And in the Nightmare series, the deal with the girls is that they, you know, we have a psychologist who says they phallicize themselves. They pick up the knife and they, and that the American population is not ready for a boy to be defalliced in any way, to lose his penis in any way, and then have to pick it up again.
And that ingenue is sort of a trope of
Yes, absolutely.
Films.
Absolutely. Sure.
So this was your first lead in a feature film?
Well, it wasn't actually. I mean, people like to say that, but I had a very strong career in New York pre. I had built up to this. This was a moment where I was going to switch from building the career to having a career. Now, building a career is years long. I mean, I have many television, movie performances, but this was a lead film.
And we're definitely coming back to some of that pre-Nightmare stuff.
Right, yeah, I mean, I sort of want to talk about your early career just because from the get-go, you were almost Destiny's darling. I mean, things just went right, and you ended up in the most amazing places, the most amazing projects. And then you got to Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which seemed like this was going to be a whole new branch, and it went not quite as right as the previous projects had gone.
Well, you know, that's true. And I think probably a few years ago, I would tell you a different story than I would tell you now.
Really?
And because of the experience that I had making the documentary, of course, come back to the Five and Dime, Jimmy Dean and Robert Altman, and that tribe was mystical and fabulous.
And you actually did that on Broadway first.
Yes, the entire cast did it on Broadway first. So it was us together, and then we made the film, and then we won like the Golden Lion and the Golden Bear, went to Cannes Film Festival. And I played Joe, what they called at the time a gay boy who, you know, came back as Karen Black. I mean, they didn't even have the word for transgendered at that point. So I played a transgendered character, although we had a lot of discussions about Joe. I was just speaking to my friend John Cameron Mitchell, and we were talking about Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And he's given an article talking about the fact that Hedwig is not trans. The character of Hedwig is not trans. The boy made a mistake to get out of Germany, and that does not make a trans person. It's a completely different issue, and I think it was the same with Joe and Jimmy Dean. I think circumstances put him there. It's a, you know, I wrote a book about for myself because I, of course, Ed Graysick owns the character. But what happened to Joe when he left, you know, the Five and Dime? It was probably a pretty tragic story.
Well, and you were working with four of the most iconic actresses of the time because you had Karen Black, you had Sandy Dennis, you had Cher.
Of course.
And
that was Cher's sort of big comeback in many ways, too. She's had a few.
Oh, that legitimized her as a stage performer, didn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Well, you know, Cher, in the documentary, in Scream Queen, we say we have a part about Cher. And Cher gave me some of the best advice in my life as far as show business go. Mm-hmm. And she said, in show business, always do what's best for you. Because that's what everybody around you will be doing, what's best for them.
And did you fully understand what she was telling you at the time?
Not at the time. I understand it completely now. I mean, I found my voice too late for that aspect of my career, absolutely, certainly for this part of my career. And the way I voiced, the way I use power now. But like when I was that young, I didn't really understand the amount of power that I had as a individual or as a performer or as a person who has some fame. I didn't understand what that power was. I had to learn. You know, I was the type of person that would call you up and I would get, you know, they'd give me a plane ticket someplace. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, oh, whatever you give me. And of course, they would give me the cheapest three-stop. Then I'd get there and my friend was sitting there with his wife and they had flown first class and they had demanded it. And I just never really felt I had the right to demand anything.
Okay. So for folks who are not quite familiar with what happened is this film is released in 1985.
That's right.
And that is at the height of the AIDS epidemic, mm-hmm. Reagan America. It's sort of, there's a rise of homophobia around this. And people had a bit of a delayed reaction to the film, but they had a reaction sort of generally that, okay, this is a gay film. You know, this is so gay. You know, they were just uncomfortable with it. They, mm-hmm. And I would agree with you around the gendered aspect of it.
But mostly I will have to, I really am really interested in keeping history straight for
Absolutely.
Myself. First of all, I want to say that the movie was incredibly successful financially.
Right.
It was incredibly successful critically. I mean, I got amazing reviews from Janet Maslin, from the London Times.
Great opening numbers.
Everything. Everything was perfect. But the whisper came from 14-year-old boys in the dark.
Right.
I always said, if you think that my the wave started there. Now, I always said, you know, when people say, well, do you think homosexuality is recognizable or when does it come? I always say, put a bunch of 5-year-old boys on a playground and they will find the homo. Almost immediately.
Yeah.
And the homo will recognize them and they'll separate. Because that's the way society is. So, yes, those boys were the first one that recognized it.
So you are also a gay man and at a time when there are no gay leading men in Hollywood.
There are no gay actors, period.
And yeah, you don't exist. And people are starting, this is this drumbeat that this is a gay film. And then when people started asking the filmmakers and everything, like, what's this about? Everyone sort of said, no, it's not us. We had nothing to do with it. It's him. They pointed at you. So
right.
That in the context of what Cher said to you,
mm-hmm.
that if, you know, you got to take care of yourself because everybody else is taking care of themselves. If you could return to that time in this moment,
mm-hmm.
What would you do differently or what would you understand differently, if anything?
I would have done exactly the same thing I did.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. Because, like, really, that didn't really start before I left. I mean, I left. There's a very clean break in my career. One day I was in the show business. The next day I was not. And it was a choice. I continued to receive offers of work. I lived in and out of Los Angeles and New York. And I had a home in New York until very recently. I live in central Mexico in Celaya, Guanajuato, which is about as far away from here as you can get. There are no güeros, no white people where I live. I'm married to a Mexican, and I live in a Mexican farm. So that tells you how far away from this I actually wanted to get. And, you know, diving back into it, it's, you know, pretty much I have the same feeling. And I can tell you one exact date, an event that ended my career. And that was I went to CBS Black Tower, which is right across the street. And I was going to play a gay character on a network television show. And I sat in a room like this with about 15 men who were all in the dark and they have their pencils going. And they began asking me questions like, would you feel comfortable playing a gay character in public? Would your girlfriend feel comfortable with that? Do you think that would end your relationship with the girlfriend? Do you think this, and this? And all of those people were homosexuals.
My God.
Homosexual men. And casting directors were mostly homosexual men. And they used their gaydar to get rid of people like me. And I had a lover at home who was sick. I had friends who were dying. And I thought that taking care of my friends and taking care of myself was more important than making a movie. And so Dustin Les Black, I think you've talked to him, right? Mm-hmm. He's talking so much about right now about, you know, movie studios, Netflix, so on and so forth. They have no problem with a gay leading man. None. A trans person, they don't care. The people that have a problem and are causing the problem right now are managers, agents, and casting directors. And most of those people are frightened for their clients to be themselves. I'm like so proud of, there's an actor named Connor Jessup, I'm sure you know him. And he came out on his 25th birthday. He's in the full bloom aspect of his career. He's a movie star. And he just refused to say, I'm not going to do this anymore. And I was him. And the only option I had was to not do it anymore, was just to leave it. You know, there wasn't a place for... Mitchell Anderson was the same, my friend, who's from Party of Five, just won an Emmy last week, hadn't acted in 30 years. Mm. Hollywood law and New York, because New York will now accept it too. You know, I was talking to some people at Broadway Cares, and they owe a huge amend to gay actors. You know, letting, not standing up for gay actors to play gay parts on Broadway when there were all straight men playing them. And there were all these gay guys sitting over in the corner, you know. It was a horrible, horrible time. And there's nothing that could make me go back to it. Nothing, 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 nothing.
Who was the actor who came out who made you think, oh, thank goodness, it's finally started?
No, that's a hard, because people started coming out in weird ways, like around Ian McKellen's The Night Out and all that kind of stuff. When that started, Angels in America was a huge break for me personally. I mean, like the Magic Theater, San Francisco, queers and gay people who just said, well, I'll just make my own product. The most exciting thing for me is actually recent, and it is Ryan Murphy, who has announced very publicly that anybody above or below the line in his company has to be gay, trans, or lesbian. And he wants only television shows controlled by those people, because he has that kind of power now. He can throw that power on things, say, well, you know, you can be in the TV show if you want, but it's going to be controlled by these people, because that is what's needed. We don't really, it's interesting to think we need a Tom Cruise or something. It's like actors have no power.
At least in the U.S. I mean, it's so interesting because the movie business, the traditional movie studio business, is sort of tracking what you're saying. They're not being like creative and edgy and trying new stuff. They're just sort of redoing these franchises, and they're focusing on the Chinese market.
Sure.
They've sort of given up.
Yeah.
You know, and they're also the ones that aren't making any headway around these kinds of characters and leadership.
I think Hollywood is all numbers driven. If a lesbian's popular, they'll put a lesbian in the thing. But they don't really want to deal with it's not really necessary to deal with a real lesbian. Right. And it's not really, I mean, this whole controversy around Scarlett Johansson and playing trans people, right? And it's her right. I agree with her. Absolutely. In a dream and an ideal world, Scarlett should play anybody she wants. And I should play any character I want. But I can also understand the trans community saying, you know, if there's a great trans role, why don't you please give it to a trans person? Yeah. There has to be one trans person in the world that can do this.
And we're starting to see that.
Yeah, and we are.
It's absolutely true.
But it's a slugfest. This is all about... ultimately, Hollywood, and I think that's what we're talking about more than anything else. You know, this is a power game. This is all about, I always say people are like, I like people who are very naive, and they say, oh, you know, if only Tom Cruise would come out, and who knows anything about Tom Cruise? And quite frankly, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? But Tom Cruise is a $5 billion, $10 billion franchise. And in this town, that, you know, if he were in fact gay, and if he was in fact wanting to come out, somebody would put a bullet in his head before they would let him do it. Because it's that power. That's the kind of power that we're dealing with here.
To get back to Scream Queen, what compelled you, because you were a producer on this film, what compelled you to make it after all this time? I mean, was it a matter of getting it together that took the time, or did you think this was the right time to do it?
No, I had really no intention of doing it. I had no intention of doing any of this. I lived in Mexico. I was quite happy. I'm very content in my own life. I'm married. I've had many businesses. Mm-hmm. I've had a very successful life. Mm-hmm. But I was contacted by these people who made a documentary called Never Sleep Again, mm-hmm. which was about the Elm Street franchise. And I had said to them, they found me. They found literally took a detective to find me. I mean, I had no cell phone. I'm not on the grid.
You truly are a unicorn.
Oh, I was. Yeah. I mean, they called me the Greta Garbo of horror. So so anyway, they found me. And I said, well, I'll do this. Because I turned down work for so long that people just gave up. And so they found me. And 2 days later, I filmed this thing. And I wanted to express my feelings about the movie that David Chaskin, the writer, had lied for many years about what he had done with this movie. So, but then Never Sleep Again is very good. It's an interesting overview of Nightmare on Elm Street, but they turned Nightmare on Elm Street 2 into a joke again. It all just became a blowjob joke. And everybody's like, oh, you know, Mark was an out actor. And, you know, they made up this story that was clever, and Nightmare on Elm Street people loved it. And I enjoyed it. It was fine. But it wasn't the truth. And then they asked me to sign with an agency to go on the road for a year, which I did, signing autographs when I was there that day. They said, well, you traveled the world doing this. And I said, okay. But I didn't know that Nightmare on Elm Street was famous. I didn't know I was famous. And when I dug into it, I was just appalled. I mean, I was really appalled.
By what?
The way that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and Jesse, the character, were treated by New Line Cinema. I was appalled by the way that Nightmare on Elm Street 2 was treated by Wes Craven, who should have bowed down and kissed Jack Shoulder's feet.
Who was the director?
Yes, for the mansion that he now lives in the Hamptons, because they didn't want to make a franchise out of this movie. They didn't want to pay Robert Englund to come back and do the second part. That's all Jack Shoulder. And then when Wes realized that it was going to be a franchise, then he just came back in and said, okay, and I'll pretend that the second part that made the $50 million that we needed to do this doesn't exist. And that, to me, is the most hateful part of this, is to disrespect your peers. Do you know what I mean? None of us get here by ourselves.
Well, and you really, in the film, sort of the biggest thing that I see the conflict around that theme, is that David Chaskin, who was the writer of the film, was very evasive about whether the gay quote subtext was intentional. Mm-hmm. Eventually, he admitted that it was, but made some very strange comments about it. That he said it was intended to be homophobic, not gay subtext, and, you know, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But he kind of threw you under the bus. At least it appeared that way.
Oh, of course. I mean, like in the documentary, David is one of those people that he's a chameleon, I think. And if you're in the room with him and you want an answer, he'll give it to you. I don't think, you know, without denigrating him in any large way, and we don't in the movie, that he has no self-esteem. He has no central core to his person. Because he would sit and give it, they would talk to him about what was going on with Scream Queen, and he was like, oh, I'm really, you know, I just want to be that person that isn't homophobic. And then the next interview he would give to somebody else and say, and the quotes are, to put it in context for your audience, I didn't make this movie as a homoerotic movie. I intended it as a homophobic movie. What would make a straight guy sick to his stomach? And it was supposed to be subtext, but then they cast the movie.
So the gayness was part of the horror.
For him. But he didn't bother to share. Yeah, no, the repulsion of a straight guy thinking that he was a homosexual was the horror. And that at one point he said, you know, that they should show this movie at conversion therapy camps, that the love of a good woman will always turn a gay man straight, which is what the end of the movie is. The heroine comes in and saves the boy. And, you know, the movie is terribly homophobic.
And the line that stuck in my head that the writer kept going back to was, at no point did I write, he screams like a woman.
Oh, he's so foul in that moment.
Yeah, that was such a horrible thing to say. And plus, there's a director on the set. You know, if something else was what you intended.
Well, you know, it's so funny because those people are just clueless. And God bless them. You know, I love Jack. Jack's had a real epiphany. The director has had a real epiphany around the last 6 months because I've been traveling with him.
Because he told you to get over it at one point.
At that time. But he now, to his credit, he took me aside a couple months ago and said and made his amends to me. He had actually gone with his wife and taken him to a yoga retreat. And I guess he had some. And he said, you know, I always thought in the movie, the boy on the back of the bus is the me. And he said, in my mind, that was always me. And I meant that boy as me. And he said, I honestly had no idea what I was doing to you. I didn't have a clue. He said, I just thought where I came from, you just push it off, shove it away. And I really want to apologize to you because I didn't know how much harm I had done to you. And that fixes everything. Now, the movie's over. The documentary is over. I can't put that in with Jack, and I wish I could. That's why I didn't want Jack here at Outfest, because the audience will turn on him. The audience turns on. We've had six previews, and the experience inside the theater is very profound, whether you know Nightmare on Elm Street or not. This is going to be, without sound hubris, this is a very important movie. It's an important piece of queer history, I think, because all the boys who see it, and it was meant for boys like me. It wasn't meant for the, it was meant for me, you know, and 20-year-old boys like me and 25-year-old boys like me, boys like I would assume you mm-hmm. had this experience. And I'm speaking to them and for nobody else. See, I don't really give a good goddamn what anybody thinks. Mm-hmm. I think I care what he thinks and what I think. Because we know it's true.
A lot of people in the film, you can see them almost sort of weeping, saying, he was my first crush. They saw them. They did see themselves.
Oh, absolutely. The boys, generations of boys now. I mean, I always can tell when they're coming up. I know all the looks. And my favorite ones are the really straight guys. You know, like they're just like straight looking. And then, or they may even be straight, right? And they want their picture taken. And then I put my hand on their back. And it's spasming. And the sweat is rolling down their back. And they're like, they're with Jesse, you know, and Jesse was their boy. So, you know, it's a pleasure.
So even though you didn't want to make this and you didn't intend to make this, it sounds like you're quite pleased with the way it's all turned out.
Oh, yes. Well, actually, I did. Now, we jumped around quite a bit. The intention to make this film was very, you don't make a movie like this by accident. This took 5 years and a lot of money to make. And Roman Tyler and I made this movie out of Roman Tyler Jensen, Roman Cimonti, and myself made this movie. And it was like pushing a rock up a hill. I'm very pleased with, I'm excited to go to Grauman's Chinese Theater and accept the accolades for this movie because we deserve all of them. Because we put every penny, every blood, sweat, and tears into this movie. And we're going to take it all the way across the finish line. Watch us. Stay with us for the next year and see what happens with this film.
So, brass tacks, people will be able to see you at Outfest.
Yes, the entire Elm Street gang is going to be there. 25 Elm Street actors will be there tomorrow. And tonight, Robert Englund will be on the red carpet with me.
Tonight would be?
Saturday evening.
Night. So this
is Grauman's Chinese Theater.
Yeah.
And then Sunday evening, we're at the Museum of Contemporary Art. They'll be showing the film there.
Okay, so we are airing this on Monday,
unfortunately. Well, I'm sure. Well, you guys all missed it. We love you. But the next time we come around. But it'll be streaming everywhere in the world.
So if people want to find out more about you or Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street, where would they go?
ScreamQueen.com. Scream Queen documentary, and just Google me.
And I just want to say that Scream, comma, Queen.
It's perfect, isn't it?
The comma is everything.
Well, you know, it's funny because that was actually the documentary was going to be called There Is No Jesse. And it's why all the Jessies disappear. And like at one point in the movie, Kim's mom says, Lisa, there's a Jesse on the phone. And all the Jessies were like, oh, there's a homo on the phone. So we became the Jessies. But Scream Queen, My Nightmare on Elm Street was going to be the name of my autobiography that I had been paid to write. But I just think it's perfect for this. So I think it works out because it's a great Google cue. I mean, everybody finds us, you know. So both Scream Queen and Nightmare on Elm Street are just fabulous lead-ins.
So thank you, Mark Patton, for coming and telling us your story.
I'm very happy to be here. I feel I'm at the center of Revolution Central here. So it's a great place to come speak truth to people. So I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure to come a couple of times, and I hope I get to come back again.
Okay, that's it for tonight. Our thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, Rainbow Minute producers, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and our director of podcast distribution, Vash Bodhi.
Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you're interested in volunteering with IMRU, email volunteer@imruradio.org.
And a reminder, because we're a global podcast, as well as a show broadcast by the station, you can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org during any hiatus from the over-the-air schedule during Fund Drive.
Also, catch us at iTunes, Spotify, Breaker, Radio Public, Stitcher, Anchor.fm, CastBox, and Pocket Casts.
I am, are you?